Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was a really smooth cut from an 80s group entitled Tears for Fears. It's called Everybody Rules the World. So I have to tell you right now, I know that so many people out there do want to rule the world. And there are a lot of great people out there that are doing their thing in the world. So this is for you to start the show off today. The Artist Remembers. Every artist remembers when and where it all began. The moment in time when the pulse of their gift begin to beat. For some, this experience begins early in life, but for others, it takes a bit longer because a spiritual cleansing must occur to get rid of the mental chains that have, for some reason, managed to bind the creativity. One of the most incredible experiences an artist encounters is when they release their inner vision from the darkness so that it can see the light of day on canvas, in music, in sculpture, in literary expression, in invention. The Artist Remembers. People of the world, I am your host, G.D. Welcome to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Sunday, March 23rd, 2014, and the time is 1:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. T.J. Haynes, beautiful son, doting father, committed educator, intriguing author. He resides in the town of New Haven, Connecticut. He holds a master's degree in education. It is an accomplishment worth acknowledging. He has been a guest on A Touch of Grace twice before, once during the premiere episode back on September 2nd, 2010, and then on the next episode a few weeks later, following the premiere episode. His Broken Gems chronicles the life of a woman by the name of Sapphire Taylor, a blue-eyed, I say, demon who survived sexual abuse only to become a vengeful and malicious woman who will do anything to get whatever she wants from whoever she wants. If you've been watching Tyler Perry's The Have and Have Nots, her life is similar to the vixen, Candace, on that show. I remember reading the touching ode he wrote about his mom prior to stepping into the pages of that novel. And what I read that day, sitting in my car, still lingers inside of my soul today. He loved his mother very much, and she loved him, and she would be so proud. It is an honor to welcome him back to A Touch of Grace. And so without further ado, I'm just going to say, hey, Tucson, what's happening?
Hey, how are you, GD?
I'm doing pretty good. Now, I slipped and called you Tucson. So for the course of the interview, is it TJ or is it Tucson?
TJ is fine. Look, most people will butcher my first name. So, you know, TJ is definitely fine.
Okay, that's great. Well, you know, it is an honor, TJ, to have you back on the show. I think that what you're doing in the world is just fantastic. You are inspiring young lives, and I just think that it is a noble, noble position that you're doing out here. So it's been a few years since we pretty much talked on the air. So how has life been treating you?
Life has been well. I've been busy. You know, the years, they just seem to kind of fly by since the last time we spoke. And it's just been a roller coaster. You know, I've been doing quite a bit.
Yeah, you have. Yeah, I've been looking at some of your posts. And I know that Connecticut has had a lot of snow and there were school closures because it was too bad to drive. So how does that affect you and the school year?
Well, put it this way. Whenever they cancel school, you know, I'm not one of those teachers that complain. You know, I can definitely use the days off. You know, I'm one of those educators that, you know, I'm at work early and I leave late. So the days that, you know, I have to myself just to kind of sit and relax, I'm not going to complain. Especially when I tell you.
Okay. Well, I like how laid back and easy it is. You know, I know that educators, I have another friend of mine from someone I used to hang out with a lot, and she would always talk about the curriculum that teachers had. I had an educator from New York on the show, K.L. Belvin, and he talked about the dynamics that, you know, he brought to teaching to actually be able to reach certain kids. So as an educator, out of curiosity, have you encountered challenges with certain students, and what are your methods? What is the TJ Haynes educational spin?
Well, I'll first, you know, start by saying that, you know, I teach on the high school level, and that in and of itself is a challenge, you know, because, you know, I teach in an inner city, and the students that I teach, you know, they come from all different types of backgrounds. So trying to, one, teach that type of student and try to get them excited about English, would, you know, in itself is just not the easiest thing to do. So just trying to get them excited about reading and about writing and trying to get them to understand the importance of, you know, being able to do it and get them college ready. But, you know, it's what I decided to take on when I went to college. So, you know, just showing them my passion for it, introducing them to the fact that I am a writer. That's one of the things that I do to try to get my students to understand that, you know, writing could definitely be something that's fun, you know, and it could be engaging. I luckily have been successful. You know, this is my 10th year in education. So, you know, I'm 10 years old now. So
I think that's amazing, and it's so funny you say that you work in an inner city. And when I think about Connecticut, the only thing I know about Connecticut is I think that my wife and kids, the family, the show with Tisha Campbell and Damon Wayans. I think that they were based in Connecticut, and it looked so beautiful. So it's hard for me to fathom that there is an inner city there. So,
could definitely dispel the persona that most people have. You know, when the media talks about Connecticut. When you see it on TV, you know, most people have the assumption that, you know, Connecticut, you're rich. You know, Connecticut is one of the most wealthiest states. However, we do have the highest, you know, inequality in terms of, you know, rich and poor in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I am originally from New Haven, and New Haven is one of the cities that has the highest income inequality. So, you know, you have people that are extremely rich, you know, and you have some people that are destitute. And the school that I teach at, you know, we have students that come from different places in Connecticut, the bus students in. So, you know, I have to kind of balance teaching it all. And, you know, I just recently moved from New Haven to another town, in Wallingford. So, you know, right down the street from me, you know, there's cows. You know, so,
I know you didn't say cows.
Yeah, there's cows, and you know, if I go out on my balcony, there's a river. You know, so you know, Connecticut's very diverse, and it's very different than what people might think on TV. And it's definitely a very beautiful place in certain areas. But then again, there's other places in Connecticut that you know are very riddled with crime and, you know, high murder population. You know, it's horrible. You know, you could just type that in Google, and you can see that New Haven actually, believe it or not, was one of the places in the country that was, I think, was number four for the highest murder capital in the state.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I think it was, like, number four, I think, the year before last. You know, I think there was, like, 34 murders in the year. 35 or something like that, you know. So it all depends on where you're at in Connecticut. So it's definitely a very interesting place to live.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I know that I grew up in a little town called East Palo Alto. We were once deemed the murder capital of the world, and that's because it was just like a dot. So for the number of people that lived there and for the number of murders that were happening, you know, it rang out as that. But then we also have Oakland that has had its series of murders, and then we also have the town of Richmond that is crazy. So the question that I have for you, okay, so here you are in an inner city. Do you remember what it was like when you walked into your classroom for the first time, what the emotions were that were inside you? Do you remember?
I do. And again, this was 10 years ago. My first day, I was nervous, but I'm not one of those people who crack under pressure. You know, I've sort of learned in life that, you know, if you put on a brave face, you know, it sort of helps me kind of navigate through life. So I never allowed myself to crack under the pressure of being like a first-year teacher, you know, straight out of college. So I was nervous. But I think just going through my coursework in college, I was sort of prepared. And at the time, I had a principal who was very supportive. And I think at that time, the kids that I taught, they were just phenomenal. Back then, the kids are completely different than the kids that I teach now. So then the kids, they had a different, you know, value set with them. They actually wanted to learn, and they used to actually compete to see who was going to do the best. So I had kids that, you know, if one kid got a 97 on a test, they were bragging, you know what I mean? And they would brag and argue and fight to see who was going to get the 98 the next time around. So it made my job a lot easier. So, you know, you might hear horror stories about teachers and their first year of teaching and how horrible it was. I never had that experience. It wasn't until later that I started to feel the pressure of, dealing with parents that didn't necessarily care or weren't really invested in their children's education. I think I was really sheltered from that my first few years of teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the friend that I told you about would always tell me some about parents that are disillusioned, thinking that, you know, little Bobby earned a C+. Well, my little Bobby should be, you know, in the elite classes, and to where these parents are just totally disconnected from, you know, the abilities that their child actually has. So I'm pretty sure as an educator you have encountered these type of people, as well as other types of parents that, like you said, are totally disconnected. So a lot of the time it seems to me like education is more almost like social work. You know, almost have to have skills as a social worker to deal with these type of people. So what do you do to prepare yourself to meet a parent like that?
You know, I think for me, it took a lot of time. Earlier on, again, because I think I was so sheltered, and I don't even know if sheltered is the right word, I just didn't have to deal with, I didn't necessarily have to deal with it because, again, my first few years of teaching, you know, I just dealt with a different type of student. Those problems I didn't necessarily have, you know, and I teach at a great school. So, you know, I teach at a magnet school, and, you know, so the students, they have to apply to get in. And I teach at a health business school. And
oh, wow.
It's a school of choice. So for the most part, the students are there because they want to be, or their parents elect for them to be there because they want their children to have a better education.
It never even dawned on me that there are high schools that could be dedicated to, you know, like you said, medicine, or, you know, gearing these kids up to actually step into their role in college, you know, in medical schools. I think that is amazing.
There's tons of schools in New Haven. Now, even though New Haven has been plagued with, you know, different types of violence, you know, and that's not to take away from the wealth of opportunities that are in New Haven. There's, you know, the hospitals. There's so many resources in New Haven. So, for example, New Haven, there's at least 12 different high schools that students can elect to go to. So if, let's say, for example, you are a student who has a passion for writing or for dance or for the arts. There's an actual high school that has a focus on just the arts. So if you want that, you would apply for that school, you know, and you would hope to get into it. There's a sports medicine school. There's two different business schools, you know. So there's schools that tailor to students' interests. I just so happen to be at the health business school. And, you know, and dealing with different parents, it's been a pleasure, I would say, for half of my tenure in education. The other half, you know, I just think that there seems to be like a generational shift where the parents are, at least in my view, are younger. They're not as invested, or there just seems to be a different perception of their children. And this is not on a whole, but this just seems to be something that I'm starting to see more and more of that I didn't see in the first half of my tenure teaching. And I just, you know, I think because I'm a little older now, you know, I'm still young, but, you know, I just think just having the experience under my belt, I just developed a certain level of patience dealing with these parents. And, you know, I just have to stay firm in, you know, what I say, because sometimes these parents think that, you know, little Johnny should be, let's say, in one of the, you know, honors classes. You know, Johnny's not demonstrating the capability of doing so, or, you know, little Johnny deserves an A when he hasn't turned in an A before, you know. So,
right,
you know,
right.
I just have to kind of make sure that all my, you know, T's are crossed and my I's are dotted so that I can show, you know, the parent, you know, this is what it is and this is what Johnny's producing, so that I know that I have done everything that I could do on my end. you know, and then at the end of the day, the parents bear the responsibility, and I think that's sort of what's lacking now, just that personal accountability. You know, it's always somebody else's fault when things go awry. So, you know, just being patient and just kind of putting it out there.
Mm-hmm. So I can only imagine. I know, you know, being a manager, when I was a manager at Stanford University, even at AT&T, when I'm managing people, that you have to have, like, documentation. But the documentation was, yeah, it was based on performance, and it could be attendance as well. So in the school district, I can imagine that that is so critical. And I know that documenting things takes quite a bit of a time. And like you said, in order to actually – make sure that you have your I's and T's crossed, you know. And even then, I could imagine, you know, you showing it to a parent in black and white, that some still will resist and probably try to challenge, you know, what they're hearing about their child. So the question that I have for you, okay, when we're talking about you've been in the school district for 10 years, so that gives at least, what, 2 classes worth of graduates that have gone off to college. Have any of those kids came back so that you know how they're doing?
Oh, absolutely. I've over the years, I've had tons of success stories from, you know, former students. I've had actually my first year of teaching, I taught seniors. One of my classes was a group of seniors, and I was only 4 years older than the seniors that I taught.
Wow.
So, you know, it's interesting even just to see them out. You know, I'm 33 now, you know, so you can just imagine, you know, they're, you know, 29, you know what I mean? So
right.
I'm not much older than my first group of students, and I've had students who've gone off to Yale and Harvard and Princeton and who are doing incredibly. I have students who are married with children and just doing fantastically. Students who gone to my first book party, you know. Former students of mine who are actually getting married on the 5th of this month. next month.
Oh, wow.
That invited me to their wedding, who want me to, you know, do a recitation of a poem. You know, it's nice, and it does speak volumes that, you know, the impact that I've had on them when they were sophomores in my class or, you know, juniors or seniors, you know, they still think highly enough of me to keep me involved in their lives and to keep me abreast of things that are going on in their lives, even when they leave the, you know, the walls of the high school. And when they go off to college and then make careers and families, and to stay in contact with me on Facebook or, you know, to give calls on occasion. I mean, it's rewarding in that sense, and that is one of the things that sort of just keeps me going in education. And that keeps me grounded because there are days, you know, that I just want to throw in the towel and say, you know, maybe I just need to do something else.
I was just about to ask you that. I was just about to ask you that. I was like, are there days, you know, and I know that we all have them, but during the days like that, you know, when you feel like throwing in the towel, you know, how do you regroup, refocus, and step back out at it again?
Those days come more and more often, believe it or not. because, you know, education is becoming more and more of a political arena. And there's more and more requirements placed on teachers, you know, and with more and more requirements, the job is just becoming more of a weight. And, you know, the days that I just come home and, you know, I can't even touch a paper because I'm just so exhausted, you know, those are the days that I just want to give up, but then I say, you know what, I am having an impact on these kids. And, you know, and then if I have to be completely realistic, you know, it's like, okay, outside of the impact I'm having on these kids, you know, I have to pay a mortgage, you know, and I have a daughter. And she's in the 7th grade, you know, and, you know, in a few years she's going to be going off to college. And, you know, and I think of my livelihood and, you know, and I think of my student loans and all the years that I put into schooling, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, I want to give up, but is that really realistic? Absolutely not. So, you know, I still got to keep going, you know, so I have to kind of just take those moments to myself and regroup and say, okay, you know what, tomorrow's another day, you know, and just kind of let the day go, you know what I mean, and go to sleep, wake up and say today is a new day and try to approach today a little differently than yesterday, kind of just keep it moving. But those days are coming, and, you know, they come, and those days are difficult. Very difficult.
Well, I know that when you were mentioning how political the education system is becoming, that's the same thing that K.L. Belden said. When he first got to whatever the school is that he works in New York, he said that there was a professor who was the music professor at the school that he worked at, and he was a former Black Panther Party. So the words of wisdom that the Black Panther Party teacher gave to him included a few cuss words in it. And so he chuckled to himself thinking, oh, my God, what teacher uses that type of language teaching? But the success rate that that guy had, I can't think of his name, was just phenomenal, because when you're talking about the type of kids that are coming from broken homes, kids that are coming from domestic violence, sexual abuse, and just those types of adverse conditions, then you would have to have a certain amount of dynamic as a teacher to be able to reach them. And it may not be what is written down or written out by some stuffed shirt that's sitting up in the superintendent's office. So I think that the killing off of the dynamic teacher is definitely something that is very sad. It's a very sad thing. Now, you mentioned raising a child. Your daughter is now in the seventh grade. So this is going to be interesting. What has it been like for you raising a daughter, and now she's in her teenage years? What's the experience been like?
She's a preteen. She's 12. She'll be 13 this summer.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a challenge, I could say. She's the light of my life. I can say without question. But the preteen years, anybody who has children, especially a girl, you know, these years are rough. These years are rough. Mm-hmm. You know, the adolescence and the hormones and, you know, these years are, oh, you know, I have one. I don't know how anybody do it with more than one child.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's something that I wouldn't change for anything in the world, you know. She is definitely a blessing. She is a blessing. Mm-hmm.
And what type of student is she? What kind of student is she? Is she a good student in school?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she's her daddy's child. Yeah, she's great. She's a smart girl. It's interesting, you know, we were just working on a project that she has for school that she's going to have to deliver before the whole school. And, you know, it's she's good. She's a dedicated student. You know, she's making sure that she's working toward college because, you know, one of the things that I've told her and one of the things that her mother's told her is that you need to make sure you get all the scholarships you can.
Because, okay, I heard that.
we're not rich. And, you know, we want to make sure that you get as many scholarships because you need to make sure you go to school. That's your requirement. That's your bare minimum. So,
What advice would you give if there's a parent that will listen? And I know parents will be listening to this show as well. What advice would you give them to help prepare their child? What do they need to do with their child to actually get them on the path? Because, you know, a teacher can only do so much for a child, you know, and you being an educator and you have your own child, mm-hmm. not many people have that luxury because some of that homework that comes home, it's like, I can't help you with this.
Right. In terms of that, for example, and, you know, and I'm going to be a perfect example, mm-hmm. you know, I'm an English, I'm a language teacher. You know, the highest math that I've gotten into when I was in school was pre-calculus. You know, anything outside of pre-calc, you know, I said, you know what, this is like Greek to me, so I just can't help you. You know, so my daughter, for example, when she gets to the more advanced math classes, I won't be able to help her. So, you know, you have to utilize the resources you have at the school. Because when she comes home with that type of stuff, I can't be that resource. Anything with English, I can help her with. But outside of that, you know, so parents have to understand that the child's job is school. It's not the parent's job to get the education. It's the child's job. Children bear that responsibility. And the more parents put that responsibility on their children, the better. Because one of the things that I definitely see as an educator, and now having done this for 10 years, is that the level of accountability is being taken away from kids, and it's being placed solely on the shoulders of teachers. You know? And this is not to absolve teachers, because teachers bear the job of teaching. But students and kids, they also bear the responsibility of learning. And if they're not getting it, they bear that responsibility of making sure that they get it. Because when they leave high school or they leave whatever grade level they're in, when you go to college, if you're not getting it from your professor, no one's going to say, well, you know, your professor didn't teach it to you, so, you have to get it. You have to get it somewhere. So parents can't always think that, you know, well, you know, my teacher, my son's child, you know, my son's teacher is not teaching it, so, you know, it's their fault. No.
Right.
Your child has to make sure that they don't get it, that they're getting it. If the teacher's not teaching it in a way that they understand, ask questions.
Right.
If they're tutoring, they need to stay out of school for tutoring. You know, I always tell my students, and I tell this to my own child, excuses are for people in jail. That's what I say. Excuses are for people in jail. I don't want to hear excuses. So, you know, the accountability has to be placed on the child. Stop blaming people. Stop blaming teachers. Stop blaming everybody. Own up to what you do. If you don't get it, find a way to get it. So that
excellent.
Would be my advice.
Excellent. Excellent advice. So now we talked about TJ the educator and the parent briefly. Let's talk about TJ the author. Let's step into the world of Broken Gems. So for those who have not been familiar with your extraordinary skills as a writer, can you tell us when you started writing creative writing and what the writing process is like for you?
I started writing creatively when I was in high school, did it for fun. I, you know, used to write poetry and short stories and, you know, friends and family, you know, used to get a kick out of it. They used to like it, you know, and they used to always tell me that I had a knack for it. But it was nothing that I ever pursued seriously. But as I got into college and, you know, I had a creative writing class in college that I really enjoyed. And I said, okay, well, this is cool. But it wasn't until I graduated and started teaching and actually started teaching creative writing is when I really, really started to take the art seriously. And at that point, when I was teaching it and my students really came alive from reading what I wrote, that's when I said to myself, okay, this is something that I really have to really invest myself in and take seriously. And the writing process for me is one that is a slow process. It's not one of those processes that's quick. You know, you hear sometimes with writers that, you know, they can turn out something very quickly. You know, it's the complete opposite for me. You know, I can't have a lot going on in my life. You know, I have to, you know, kind of seclude myself from things, and, you know, I have to have certain music playing and candles lit and, you know, maybe a glass of wine or two, and, you know, and I have to really kind of submerge myself in what I'm doing. And that's what I have to do in order for, you know, the creative juices to flow. But it kind of worked out. We broke it in.
Yeah, it actually did. So the question that I have for you, thanks, you explained that very well, because I can relate. Hell, I'm a writer too. Having that climate, that perfect climate to actually do the writing in. Most definitely, we have to seclude ourselves off. So it's almost like a labor of selfishness when it comes to being creative. But what I question I have is Broken Gem. Why this story? Was there anything in you that said, I need to write this story, or did you just say, I think it'd be interesting to write this story?
Well, I would say initially there wasn't a burning desire to write the story.
Mm-hmm.
But as the story progressed, it became a burning desire. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Initially, when I started writing the story, I was teaching creative writing to a group of students. And at my school, the creative writing courses are elective. And so that comprises of sophomores through seniors. So these are students who elect to take the course. They have an interest in creative writing. And for that particular year, the students that I had, they were very motivated students. And it was a really fun class. So this is the class that I decided that, okay, everything that I expect for all of you to do, I'm going to do myself. So I had a unit where I was teaching the students about character development. So I just, off the top of my head, started to draft the main character, Sapphire, for the book. So I just wanted to create this really scandalous character. And I just started creating her off the top of my head one day, you know, and I wanted to bring it in the next day to kind of show the kids on how to draft, you know, a character. And when I started to create this character, you know, I wanted to give her more of a background.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to write more. And the more I started to write, the kids, they just couldn't let it go. You know, they really couldn't even get into their own writing because they were so enthralled in what I was writing. So I started this to share it with, you know, friends, and they loved it. Shared it with family, they loved it. So, you know, I said, okay, well, this is kind of cool. You know, I got nice reactions from people, you know. And it was, I sort of pat myself on the back. So I said, okay, this is nice. So I just went about my business, taught the rest of the year, and I decided that the reaction that I got from people was so positive that it was definitely something that I should keep expanding upon. And from there, I said, okay, well, I really should take this further. And at the time, my mother was still living. And, you know, she was ill, though. And I said, this would be interesting if I could in some way build this novel that I have in my head around the strength of women. And I just kind of thought about the strength that I've always known from her and the strength that I've known from my grandmother and just the women that I've been around in my life. And then I was like, okay, well, how am I going to put the strength of this woman that I look up to, you know, my mother and my grandmother, with this scandalous woman that of this character that I created? Like, how do I marry the two? So I had to kind of find a way to marry the two, and I did. But that just created this burning desire to, okay, I got to put this together creatively and make something that people are going to really respond to. And I did, you know, and the only regret that I have is that I just didn't work on it sooner, because I would have loved for her to have been alive to read the whole thing while she was here. But, you know, I that's why the book is dedicated to her. But, you know, I definitely think that she would definitely be proud of what I put out.
I know she would. And there's a symbolic message about the title Broken Gem. And I remember it, but I want you to say it in your own voice. What is the symbolic meaning of that title?
Okay, so Broken Gems, it's symbolic of how the main character, well, at least this is the way it initially started. The main character, her name is Sapphire, and when I created her, she had a very, very troubled past. And on the surface, I wanted to create a character that people would just hate it. I wanted this to be a character that women, men, anybody who read her and her actions, they would detest her. They would just want to shake her, fight her, take her to the parking lot. Like, I wanted her to be that character. And upon reflection and upon really, really pulling back the layers, I wanted to kind of humanize her and to give people something to think about and to kind of understand why she was the way she was and understand that behind all of it, she was just a broken individual. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it started. But then as I started to create the rest of the characters in the book, all of the strong female characters in the book, they all ended up having issues of varying degree. So all of the women characters in the book were flawed in some way. They all had mm-hmm. some issue that they had to overcome. So they all, for me, became my gems, and they all were broken in some way. So they were my gems. You know, they were my metaphors of gems, and they were all broken in some way. So it's interesting that I gave the novel the title Broken Gems. They, women especially with the groups that I talk to and the fans of the book, women can relate to this book so well because they see themselves in these characters. They mm-hmm. had girlfriends that they see in these characters. You know, they might have children that they see in these characters. And this book is so real and is raw. And
yeah.
people genuinely do understand what these women are going through. And it's hard to place a negative judgment on any of these women once people read the book. You know, they might hate these people, but they understand their actions. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why this book, I think, is so powerful in so many ways.
Yeah, it's a very powerful book. And when I've heard the explanation for it before, so I know, so I'm glad that you re-explained it for the listeners today. It reminds me of, I like the metaphor. You know, it reminds me of Valley of the Dolls. It's an old movie, and, of course, dolls were pills. But, you know, I wanted the audience to hear the explanation for that, and you did it so great. And the book is fantastic. So whoever is listening out there right now, if you want a good read, it's an easy read, too, because TJ writes so flawlessly. You will just love it. So I want to go ahead and get the plug for the website where the book can be published. So where can, not published, but purchased, where can the book be purchased at, TJ?
The book can be purchased at several different outlets. It can be purchased at Barnes & Noble website. So that's www.bn.com. It can be purchased at Amazon.com. It can be purchased on my website. And from my website, it will come to you personally autographed. And that's www.authortjhaines.com. And you can also order it from my publisher's website, and that's www.pheink.com. That's pheink.com.
Mm-hmm. Now, I love pheink. Thank you for that, because I definitely
yes.
want to make sure that we're supporting and these people and the people that are listening can actually find it, because they're going to love it. Once they trust me, if you read it, you're going to love it. Now, I want to talk about pheink. You guys, I'm just fond of PHE Inc. I just have a wonderful relationship with all of you, And I know that T.L. Jane's president, I had her on a couple of days ago, and then I'll have Miss Jean Holloway on tomorrow with her deck of cards. But, So how did that union come together, and what has the experience been like for you as an author there?
My experience with FEAC has been nothing short of amazing, I have to say. Originally, I was self-published through a company that was not so much of a positive experience.
Right.
It was a learning experience. And there was a person under the imprint of Fate Inc. who happened to have read Broken Gems and sort of kind of just told, you know, T.L. James about my book and told her that it was really good, you know, and kind of put in a word for me. And she read it, and we sort of, you know, got in contact that way, and we talked, and it just was a seamless marriage after that. You know, she read it, and it was something that I believe she immediately thought, okay, this is somebody that I have to have under my imprint, and it was a blessing for me. You know, it was an absolute blessing that she saw my talent. And it was a blessing that from then, you know, a contract was offered, you know, because, you know, I was in such a bad situation prior to seeing that. You know, it was definitely like, you know, the clouds parted and, you know, she came in with a chariot and angel wings, and it was like, hallelujah, you know, and it was great, you know, and I've been so very blessed since. You know, there were so many things that happened since, you know, I was able to, you know, get my book sold through Barnes & Noble and, you know, Amazon, and, you know, it just opened up my fan base even more. You know, I was able to do radio, and, you know, the redesign of my book cover, which was, you know, stepped it up from what it was before to what it is now, you know. And there's so many things that's happened under Feet Inc., and, you know, there's the prospect of a potential book tour, you know, later in the summer. And, you know, there's so many things that are on the horizon that an opportunity that I just would not have had before. And, you know, T.L. James, she's just been so patient with me, you know, since the re-release of Broken Gems. You know, because when I released Broken Gems, I've since then got another degree, you know. So there's been a lot of things that's happened since I've released Broken Gems. You know, life has gotten in the way of, you know, I was supposed to release the sequel last year, but the writing process has not necessarily has happened as quickly as I would have liked. You know, because, you know, I've had issues with work and going back to school and getting another degree, and, you know, so, because I ended up getting a degree in addition to my master's. So, you know, but she's like, okay, I understand, you know, take your time, just make sure that is right, you know. So, you know, I'm 12 chapters into the sequel.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You know, I think that's what I love a lot about TL. I mean, I already knew that, you know, all of you were great people. I already knew that. I already knew that T.L. was just wonderful. I remember when I read her book, and it's so funny that you mentioned the experiencing, like, the clouds opened up and then an angel descended because, you know, there's an angel in her book. But I think that there's a lot of symbolic meaning behind great relationships that are built like that. And I know the story And I won't do the Wendy Williams thing because you know I really am tempted to go there, but I won't go there because this is not what type of show that is. Because I remember the story behind the current cover and what the story was about the other cover and why there had to be a change. You also mentioned about how you emerged from that moment with that other publisher and how successful it has been. So for me, I think that says it all right then and there, is that, you know, you keep a decency about you. You certainly could have done a lot more things to do some slamming, but that just shows just how classy you are. So for everyone listening today, this hour has been about the author from PH Inc. Publishing, and that's an indie publishing house out of Houston run by T.L. James, and Gene Holloway actually helps out as well. Great authors, great stories, professionalism. I've been talking to T.J. Haynes. And so right now what I want to do, and I'm going to come back to you, T.J., in just a moment. So I want you to think about this question, and then when I come back, I want to hear what your answer would be, and I like doing this. What would you tell 12-year-old TJ? Words of wisdom. So think about that for a minute, and I'll come right back to you, okay?
Okay.
All right, so we have upcoming shows. Destiny Meets Grace with author Destiny Carter on Friday, the 28th of March at 1:30 p.m. And then on the 29th, which is Saturday, we have poet Donovan Brown, who will be joining us to discuss his poetic gift. And then we will have Michael McGrew, author, and I call Michael McGrew an ambitionist because that is one ambitious brother, I got to tell you. He just had a son a few months ago, so I'm really excited about him. But he's going to be joining us on Thursday, the 3rd of April at 1:30 p.m. God, these months are flying by. So as you can see, the talent just continues to filter through the airwaves of A Touch of Grace. I got to do some shout-outs to my friends over at the global platform at CMIX Radio, as well as my friends at World Media, namely Mr. Wayne Barrows, who made the Howard Hewitt and Francine Lucas interview possible. I'd also like to give a shout-out to Marcine Yu Savant, who has just really becoming a great friend. He is one of the executive producers over at Iron Violet Theater and Film for being such a great encouragement to me and a support of the show A Touch of Grace. So I'm going back to the author of the hour, and that is T.J. Haynes. TJ, what would you tell 12-year-old TJ?
I would tell 12-year-old TJ to remain focused because that's one of the things that I feel has led to me being relatively successful and that I say is the key to anything in life, is just maintaining focus. You know, and it has paid off in everything that I've done, whether it be the 3 degrees that I've obtained, whether it be, you know, the parent that I've become, whether it be the book that I've written and the book that I'm writing now, whether it be my weight loss, you know, anything that I've put in my mind, I've had to maintain, you know, focus. And that's something that I think would benefit everyone, is just dedication and focus. So that's what I would tell 12-year-old, because, you know, I had to learn that lesson a little bit later. And I think learning that lesson a little bit earlier, who knows where I would be now if I would learn that just a little bit earlier. So that focus, I think, is going to be important. So.
Mm-hmm. I think that you said that very eloquently. I know that your mom would be proud. I felt her presence here during this broadcast. I think she raised a remarkable young man who is in turn being a remarkable parent to his very own seed. And I think that those were wonderful words of wisdom. And so the question that I have, one of the final question of the hour, is how far along are you in the writing of the sequel, and will the sequel be titled Broken Gem 2, or have you got that far yet?
I am 12 chapters into the sequel. I do have a goal to definitely finish the sequel this summer. I'm clearing my schedule this summer so that I can dedicate myself to finishing it, because the fans have been very, very overly patient with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I owe it to them to set aside time to make sure that they get exactly what they're waiting for. And so far, it's insane what I've come up with. So they're going to be very happy. I can say that. The tentative title will be Broken Gems 2 Diamond Strong. But I don't know just if that's going to be the actual title, but that's the tentative title. So we'll see.
I like that. Wow. And how dare you tease me and don't have – how dare you tease me and not even have the product?
Well, but you know what? Anybody who's friends with me on Facebook, they do have some previews of the new book. I have released the first four chapters of the new book, just as a little kind of wet your whistle sort of thing.
Well, aren't you sweet? You know I'm going back to look, right?
Yes. I have a whole Broken Gems group. You know, if you're friends with me, all you got to do is ask, and, you know, I will put you in the Broken Gems group, and you can get the preview to the new book.
I got to get better, but I'm glad you put it in the forefront for me, because I got so many people that, you know, I'm pushing and supporting, and you're one of them, too. So I'm definitely going to push that, because, brother, you bad. That's all I got to say. So I'm going to let you go back on and enjoy the rest of your afternoon this beautiful Sunday. And I just want to say thanks, TJ, for being not only just a good colleague, but just a wonderful friend. I really appreciate you, okay?
Oh, thank you for having me on. And I have to say congratulations to you, you know, definitely on the reboot of your show. And, you know, I was your first guest when you first started, and, you know,
yep.
I'm more than happy to come on anytime you want me on. And, you know, you're doing big things, and I'm definitely proud of you.
Thank you so much.
You deserve all the success in the world.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you, and know that that is a ditto. So you take care, and I'll be talking to you soon. And if there's anything I could do, you let me know, okay?
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Okay, take care. All right,
bye-bye.
Everybody. So that was TJ Haynes, a very extraordinary young man. Oh, my God. I just am so inspired by him. He's doing so many great things. And I have to tell you, if you haven't read Broken Gems yet, you need to go out there and get it, because it's a fantastic book. You won't be able to put it down. So the final word that I'd like to leave today, and you know GD always got a little final word he's trying to do, it's called Powerful Key. A lack of communication leads to many misses, misunderstanding, misinformed, misleading, etc., which can cause reactions of defensiveness, anger, etc. And buried in the layers of all that lack of communication lies the infective culprits I define prejudgment and assumption. Deeper within those layers are insecurity and feelings of inadequacy, lies that block the light. I have found that too often we get in our own way. And when we get stuck in our preconceived notions about people, places, and things, and the ulterior motives of possible opportunities, we block our blessings. It takes courage to admit personal weaknesses, but I have found that when we do face our fears instead of keeping them concealed within our own minds, we allow ourselves to be in that vulnerable state where the magic of personal growth happens. This is not pulpit preaching. I share it. It's just an epiphany I seem to have been in the midst of a few years ago, and I wanted to put it out there. Sharing ideas and thoughts is one powerful key that can unlock the door of infinite possibilities, and we all have our own set of keys. We all have the power of using those in our possession. So what I want to say is, if you got a crowd that you're running with that really is not empowering you to be the best that you could possibly be, and I don't mean them, you know, enjoying everything that you're saying. I mean that encourages you. You know, you got to make changes to get what you want. You know, I had to do that. You know, so powerful keys we all hold. So love yourself, and more importantly, know that GD loves you very much. Thanks for making the show 30,000 plus strong, and we'll talk to you soon. God bless.